Today at Reader's Corner, we welcome David Daley, author of Unrigged: How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Author and journalist David Daley is considered one of the nation's leading experts on gerrymandering. His first book charted the troubled evolution of gerrymandering and voter manipulation in the United States. In his newest book, Unrigged: How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy, Daley shares the stories of those fighting back, delving into the efforts to fight partisan gerrymandering, the movements that helped shape the historic 2018 victories for the Democrats, and the victories to secure voting rights. In an age of polarization, Unrigged offers a vivid portrait of a nation transformed by a new civic awakening and provides a blueprint for the unending fight to keep American democracy afloat. David Daley's journalism has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Slate, The Washington Post, and New York Magazine. He was the editor of Salon and is a senior fellow at FairVote. David Daley, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Real pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Bob.
So, David, let's start with a little bit out of your former book, where you really give us the history of this gerrymandering, the history of Red Map, as it was called. Could you share with us what has happened to the reapportionment of congressional and legislative districts in recent years? I think the first chapter of your book is called The Mastermind. That's the previous book. And you cover that in the beginning of Unrigged as well. Tell us how this all came about.
Yes, I think if we want to really understand where our politics is right now in this country, we have to go back and we have to sort of take a real look at how the Republicans strategized as far back as 2008 to really prepare themselves for the changing demographics of the nation. If you go back and look at 2008, you've got the election of Barack Obama, the nation's first Black president. Democrats won a supermajority in the U.S. Senate that night, and they held on to the U.S. House and won state legislatures and governorships around the nation. And some of the smartest minds in American politics on both sides, on every cable news network that night, said that the Republican Party was going to be in trouble and might be a minority party in this nation for a generation. And of course, it didn't exactly turn out that way, did it?
No, it didn't.
And that is in many ways because some savvy Republican strategists recognized that as historic as the 2008 election was, the 2010 election had the ability to be much more consequential because it was a census year. And we redraw every legislative and congressional map in the nation after a census. It's redistricting. And that is the nice word for it. Gerrymandering is the not so nice word, which comes about when the politicians who are in charge of drawing these lines rig them in such a way as to advantage themselves. And you had a handful of Republican strategists who sort of looked at 2010 and they recognized the opportunity that it presented. The Democrats had won so big in 2008 that Republicans looked likely to have a rebound year in 2010. Usually the party on the out picks up a bunch of seats in the midterm election. And if Republicans could focus them and concentrate on these key states like, you know, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan, Florida, they would be able to redraw the district lines in all of these states the following spring and summer. They'd have the ability to do that not with sort of the magic markers and old parchment maps that politicians used when they were drawing these lines, even in the 1990s and 2000s. They'd be able to do this in 2011 with the benefit of the most sophisticated computer software, the biggest sets of data. They would be able to draw lines that endured for a decade. And that is exactly what they did. These maps have provided Republicans a firewall in many states around the nation, given them a big advantage in the race for Congress. And I think that it's played an important part in sort of pushing our politics in a more polarized and extreme direction on both sides, really. When you have that many uncompetitive districts, it means that you are pushing power away from the general election into party primaries that tend to be dominated by the extremes. So it's been a, you know, I think a really dangerous growth on our politics.
Well, I'd like to go through the book and talk about some of the people and some of the initiatives that worked so well for folks, especially since 2018. But before I get there, I'd like to zero in on perhaps it's a difference here between Republican officials who engineered Red Map and the various state efforts to suppress the vote and Republican voters, not just Republican voters, but Democrats and independents as well, who, given the majorities so many of these ballot initiatives achieved, it seems as though they voted against the anti-democratic designs of Republican Party leaders. Would I be correct in assuming that? I mean, like in Idaho, 60% voted for Medicaid expansion. And let me tell you, as red as Idaho is, there were a lot of Republicans, some of whom are my friends, who I know voted for that. In Florida, 64% voted for the initiative we'll mention in a minute. That's a pretty significant point, it seems, in helping our listeners understand that this is the work of party officials, but it doesn't necessarily seem to reflect the, I don't know whether you want to call them the rank and file or the people who just call themselves Republicans or whatever they are.
I think you are exactly right. And I think that that is a really important point, and it gives me a lot of hope as we look at our politics right now. So I had written this first book on partisan gerrymandering with a difficult name to say on public radio. And I had, you know, when you write about partisan gerrymandering and election rigging, it's easy to get sort of really depressed about the state of the nation. And what I wanted to do in Unrigged in the new book was try to find my hope again. And I found it in all of these amazing statewide initiatives on behalf of democracy reform and on behalf of voting rights. And I think that the theme that ties them together is that all of these victories were won because citizens found a way to stand together outside of the traditional party lines, outside of red versus blue. They really put all of that aside, and they took on these big structural problems that had broken our politics that both parties had done, you know, plenty of over the years. Republicans perhaps more recently, but I mean, Democrats are no angels in any of this, you know, going back decades either. And they found a way to sort of step outside of their red uniform or their blue uniform and talk to one another and make change. You cannot win Medicaid expansion in Idaho with 61% of the vote with just Democrats, right? Because right. That's about 12% of the voters in Idaho. So a lot of Republicans in Idaho and independents in Idaho had to come around. You do not win felon voting rights in Florida with 64% of the vote if a lot of Republicans and independents aren't on board. You don't win redistricting reform with upwards of 60 and 70% of the vote in Ohio, in Michigan, in Missouri, in Colorado, in Utah, with a smaller, closer number. You don't win that without a lot of people on all sides of the aisle coming together to say, we want fair elections. Gerrymandering is cheating. It's wrong. We don't like it. We want our elections to be fair. We want every voice to be equal. And I think we ought to take a lot of hope in the fact that everyday Americans nationwide in red states and blue states and purple states all feel that way. And as we head towards an election this fall that's going to be contentious, it's going to be a divisive. We're hearing a lot of, you know, partisan fights about, you know, vote by mail and things like that. I think we can take a lot of comfort in the fact that everyday Americans nationwide very much value and will fight together for free and fair elections.
You're listening to David Daley. He's the author of Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to save democracy. Voter fraud seems to be the bogeyman for partisans who see the need to restrict access to the polls. And you share with your readers a story of the Kansas Secretary of State, Kris Kobach, who led the charge on voter fraud. That didn't work out so well for him, did it?
It did not. He was kind of like this, he's Inspector Clouseau, but he looks in the mirror and he's Sherlock Holmes, you know? What I think is important to recognize about voter fraud is that it's extraordinarily rare in this country. It's especially rare when you consider how often it is talked about as a boogeyman, but it's as difficult to find as the Loch Ness Monster. And Kobach in Kansas is unable to prove a voter fraud. As the co-chair of the President's Commission on Voter Integrity, he's unable to prove voter fraud. And when you look at the number of fraudulently cast ballots in this nation in the over the last 20 years, you're talking about hundreds of millions, billions of votes, and it's being hit by lightning. It is such a small, tiny number. And we all want our elections to be safe and secure. The trouble is that a lot of these voter fraud arguments are being raised not to make our elections safer and more secure, but to place barriers between people in the ballot box, such as voter ID or making it tougher to register or purging rolls or eliminating days of absentee voting or requiring lots of signatures or a notary to vote by mail. All of that does more to discourage voting in very real ways than the actual minuscule cases of voter fraud, the needles in a haystack that people go out hunting for.
One of the barriers to voting came from a very high place in American government, the U.S. Supreme Court. What role does the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the 2013 Supreme Court decision overturning one of its sections play in energizing these activists in so many state and local communities?
I think it's a really important one. In addition to the redistricting efforts that the Republicans embarked on over the course of this decade, I don't think there's anything more important in creating our modern playing field than the 5-4 decision that Chief Justice Roberts authored in Shelby County versus Holder, a 2013 case from Alabama, that essentially gutted the enforcement mechanism of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which is called preclearance. So there were, states largely across the South that had a history of prejudicial voting laws. And if they wanted to make any changes to their election law, they had to run them past the Justice Department first and demonstrate clearly that there was no race-based intent or effect. And in 2013, the court calls a preclearance unconstitutional, essentially throws it out. And it had been working for all of these years. And the Chief Justice said, because it had been working, there was no longer a need for it. In her dissent, Justice Ginsburg said, just because it's raining, you don't throw away your umbrella and think you won't get wet. And what has happened is that, voting rights in the South have gotten soaked. Ever since the Shelby County decision, you've seen 33 million Americans purged from voting rolls across the country. You've seen thousands of precincts closed around the country. You've seen days of early voting, most of them the days on which young voters and Black voters and Latino voters were most likely to go to the polls have been eliminated. You've seen voter ID requirements enacted in states that have been surgically focused to determine the forms of ID that young voters and minority voters are least likely to have, and then they require precisely those forms of identification. Legislators have done exacting research into this and planned it out. And all of this has been made possible by that ruling in Shelby County.
Maybe this is a good moment for you to tell us about the Alabama Voting Rights Project. That seems to follow on the heels here of what we're talking about as far as voter restrictions are concerned.
Getting to go out and tour the country and see these inspiring efforts firsthand was just such an honor and thrill. And Alabama is one of these states where a disenfranchisement has really been written into the state constitution. So if you go back to the days after the Civil War, days we're all thinking about a lot these days, with a civil unrest and Black Lives Matter. In the days after the Civil War, states had to ratify the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, emancipation, a Black citizenship, et cetera, as a precondition of coming back into the Union. And a lot of the Southern states were not especially interested in doing this, but they had no choice. So many of them did, but then they enacted their own state constitutions that sort of subtly worked to undercut those protections. So in Alabama, for example, they extended the franchise to Black voters, but they also said that if you had a felony that involved moral turpitude, and then they defined moral turpitude really as a crime that a poor Black person in Alabama in 1870 was most likely to commit, like, you know, petty theft or perhaps looking the wrong way at a white person, those would become felonies that would cost you those voting rights. And these laws stayed in effect well into the last decade. And even though the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1980s tried to do something about this, and the state essentially refused to alter the spirit of moral turpitude, there was another lawsuit that was pending in 2016, and the state realized they were going to have to do something about it. So they gave voting rights back to people who had served their prison time and come back into civic life. They simply didn't tell them that they had gotten their voting rights back. So to make a long story even longer, the Alabama Voting Rights Project goes about trying to find all 70,000 of these people and to sign them back up. And they had to go door to door and bus station to a barbershop and outside libraries and shopping malls. And, you know, I joined them on this as we went out hunting for voters. And outside the bus station in Birmingham, Alabama, one morning, we met a Black woman in her mid to late 30s. And she was on her way to work, you know, it's like 6 a.m. And we approach her and we say, well, we're talking about a change in the law about voting. And she says, I can't vote. And we said, well, this is about a change that says if you've had a felony conviction in your past, you might be able to get your right to vote back. And she says, well, I can't vote. I was convicted. I had a drug possession conviction when I was 17. I've never voted. And that's how vicious these laws are, right? These laws from the 1870s had ensnared this woman in the 1990s as a teenager. She lost her right to vote forever for a simple marijuana possession charge, and she'd never voted in her life. This is what the Alabama Voting Rights Project did. And we went and we signed that woman back up to vote on the spot. There's tears in everybody's eyes, and she vowed she would be a lifelong voter.
So in Utah, a slightly different approach is taken. It's called Better Boundaries. Catherine Cantor, I believe, is the heroine here. But I'd like you to talk about what they did and mention Jeff Wright along the way, because I think it shows once again how people from across the political spectrum are dealing with this issue of gerrymandering and find a way to solve it.
Yeah, I loved going out to Utah and meeting with these really interesting Republicans who were disgusted by the way that gerrymandering carves up communities and affects a representation. And it offended them as people who want to see good government. And you obviously can't win reform in Utah if you don't have the backing of Republicans like Idaho. It's an overwhelmingly Republican state. And there were these really impressive statewide leaders who said, this is important. Gerrymandering is bad for democracy. And if we here in Utah can show that we can fix it here, we can be a symbol for the entire country that this has to be fixed.
And boy, it did. You're listening to David Daley. He's the author of Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. So I did not know until reading your book how severely restricted Native Americans have been in regard to voting. Could you just briefly help our listeners understand some of the history here and what Willie Gray Eyes decided to do about that?
Native Americans did not have the vote in Utah until 1957,
which I had no idea.
Is kind of staggering. And I traveled across San Juan County in Utah, which is sort of the southernmost county, largely Navajo land. It's the size of New Jersey. You know, it's a massive county, majority Navajo, but dominated by two northern white towns, Blanding and Monticello. And the white minority has dominated politics there ever since Brigham Young came through, 150 years ago. And through all kinds of various tricks, whether it was refusing to register Navajo voters, refusing to have translated ballots, or incredibly gerrymandered districts that they simply refused to redraw decade after decade, even after the Justice Department comes in and looks at the schools and looks at the voting conditions, and they say, we haven't seen anything so bad in this country since we were in the South in the 1950s. You just never had any change at all. And finally, just ahead of 2018, there were a series of court rulings that forced San Juan County to redraw its deeply gerrymandered maps that essentially gave one district to Blanding, one district to Monticello, and one district to the Navajo. So it had long ensured that the white minority in this district would hold a 2-1 advantage on the public, a county commission, and would be able to control all of the resources, whether that's, estate dollars or federal dollars, school dollars, investment dollars. And so you'd have those towns up north that thrived, and then you would have incredible poverty down in the Navajo parts of the county. As soon as that happened, you had essentially one Navajo district, one competitive district, and one district for the towns that were whiter. You had a candidate named Willie Gray Eyes, a Navajo candidate, that ran in the competitive district and won in 2018. That is now a 2-1 Navajo district. And as you see what has happened in Navajo Nation as a result of this pandemic, as you see, it's been hit harder than any state in the nation. It is a result in many ways of the lack of political power, the lack of economic power, the lack of investment in healthcare that has happened in these counties over the years. And you begin to, have some hope that maybe some of this can change.
Well, you've given me the perfect segue with that mention of lack of healthcare. What caught my initial interest in your book was the chapter on Idaho's successful campaign to expand Medicaid by a group called Reclaim Idaho, led by none other than Luke Mayville and his compatriots. Why did you find that such an interesting example as you were moving across the country? Because this is the one chapter in your book that isn't specifically about voting rights or some relationship to gerrymandering, but boy, it sure is about citizen initiative.
I really wanted to look at citizens who were standing up to battle structural unfairness in their state. And what you had in Idaho was 6 years in a row in which the legislature had refused to accept the dollars under the Affordable Care Act to expand Medicaid, despite the fact that there were, you know, somewhere between 60 and 70,000 of folks in the state that could have benefited from this, given the, you know, status of rural health and rural hospitals. It would have gone a long way towards improving the life of everyday folk in Idaho. And when I first saw a story about what was happening out there, that you had regular young people standing up for their neighbors, driving around the state in an RV, trying to use the lessons of persuasion and organizing that they learned in school to make their state better, and that it was working. It just seemed to be such a perfect example of all of what I was talking about coming together. You know, I mean, people are forced to take drastic action and really get involved when they feel like their voices aren't being heard, right? And Idaho's one-party legislature left a lot of people feeling as if their voices weren't being heard, not simply Democrats, but people who needed help felt as if their legislature wasn't listening to them. And there was no a real sense that that would change before Reclaim Idaho began driving that big green RV around the state and put this on the ballot and forced that change.
I think you start that chapter on Idaho by taking us up to Sandpoint, Idaho, which is far northern Idaho, which is known for its right-wing causes over the years. And yet I think there's something in there where you talk about Luke Mayville getting out there, signing people up for this initiative, and one day realizing that they're talking to people who are not necessarily liberals or independents or even Democrats.
I think that's exactly right. And I think this takes us back to what we were talking about at the beginning, that our politics need not be as polarized as they are. And when we talk to one another, we can persuade each other and we can find common ground. And I think what Luke and Garrett and Emily and everybody who was involved up in Sandpoint working on the school levy battle up there realized was that going door to door, knocking on people's doors and talking to them about the issue was the best way to, you know, change minds and win hearts. And they were not only talking to Democrats and independents, they were talking to Republicans and conservatives, but they were able to flip the results there. It had been almost 2-1 against the school levy in the previous vote. And by going up and organizing and talking to folks in the next round, it was 2-1 in favor. And that gave them a lot of, I think that's what is so exciting for people, is we have this sense that our politics are stuck, that our politics are broken, that we're all polarized and siloed, and we can't even have Thanksgiving dinner with people who disagree with us. And I mean, maybe it's not like that, right? I mean, maybe if we just go out and start talking to one another again, you know, turn off whatever, you know, siloed red or blue newscast we're watching, and just look for some common ground with our neighbors. There's a lot of proof around the nation in Idaho and elsewhere that common ground is right there to be claimed.
Well, that is a great way to end our conversation, David. And also, I must point out to our listeners that there are so many more examples from various states, like Michigan, for example, Virginia, Washington, that I had hoped to get to, but we only had so much time. But that's the reason why we go out and buy books. And the name of the book is Unrigged: How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy by David Daley. David, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me, Bob.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.